Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello to everyone out there in Metzville, and a very sincere happy holiday season to all from the Metzian podcast. And we're here to talk about our favorite baseball team, the New York Mets. There's never a dull moment around this team, and that's a good thing. You know, there have been years when we were just begging for moves and begging for, you know, the kind of moves that would grab headlines. Well, no more of that. That's not a concern anymore, so there's always plenty to talk about. It's been exactly 3 weeks since our last podcast, so there's plenty to talk about tonight. And to help me do that, this is Rich Farago, by the way, known as MetFanRich on Twitter. And I'd like to bring on my two partners in podcasting, and we have a special guest to introduce as well. But first, let me go to my two partners. So let's start in the borough of Brooklyn for now, but I guess that's not going to be the case much longer. Mr. Mike LeCollin. Mike, how are you doing tonight?
Hello, Rich. I'm doing well, pushing forward. And, I'm winding it down in Brooklyn. I'll be moving to Staten Island. And there's a name for us, people from Brooklyn who move to Staten Island, and that's Brooklander. So I'm officially a Brooklander now.
How about that? I believe that same moniker applies to someone who's been on our podcast before, Mr. Keene from the Cranepool Society. I believe he did exactly the same thing. So next time I talk to Steve, I will mention a Brooklander. See, I learned something new tonight.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Very good. Life's about learning, right? So let me go to my other podcasting partner. You know, we say this every time, but only because it's true. We don't know where Sam is. We asked Sam to tell us where in the world we find him this evening and then how he's doing. So, Sam, can he answer both questions, please?
I am doing well. I'll start with that. Thank you, Rich. And I am in the borough of Manhattan right now, on the island of Manhattan. And it's nice to see, being in Midtown, to see all of the tourists block their way back. I think it's apparently the first time since 2019 that we've hit certain numbers regarding tourists. And there's a part of me, of course, that is happy to see that, because it means business is starting to things are starting to get back to normal, and there's money coming into the city. And at the same time, I'm like, get the bleep out of my way.
You know, I don't know. Living in the area and having lived in the city a bit, I'm not sure if I'm a tourist now at this point, you know, coming in from Connecticut, but I went in the city a few weeks ago on a Saturday to do the typical tree and, you know, different things. And there was no shortage of people, let me tell you that. So that's a good sign. And I think just like a couple of years ago, you couldn't go see the tree. And then 1 year you had to have an appointment to see the tree. You had to book online and they only let a few people at a time. So it's nice to see the hustle and bustle back, even though, you know, for those who live in the city like yourself, Sam, it could inspire if you get out of my way moments, right?
Oh, yeah. And you know the real New Yorkers, because we're walking next to the cars on the outside of the sidewalk.
And all right. So before we start unpacking all things Mets, let's introduce our very special guest this evening. And this is someone who has been on the Metsian podcast several times and over and above that. Is one of the founders and writers for Faith in Fear and Flushing, and also the author of a couple of books on the Mets. And we're going to give him a chance to talk about all that. But for right now, we just want to say hello to a very famous person in Metsville, Mr. Greg Prince. Greg, how are you doing tonight? And happy holidays to you, sir.
Happy holidays and New Year to everybody here. Mike, please give my regards to John Franco, another Brooklander, I believe, along with Steve Keene. So quite the Met representation now there. I wasn't too sure when it was just Steve and John, but now that I know Mike's going to be there, I'm feeling pretty good about Staten Island. Other than that, doing okay here. Yeah, it's the end of December, so it must be baseball season somewhere, right?
Well, Greg, let's start right there. I wasn't planning on it, but since you mentioned it, you always talk about the baseball solstice. So tell us what that's about and tell us where we are chronologically in relation to the baseball solstice.
Okay, well, baseball solstice is a good word for it. I call it the baseball equinox, but it's the same idea. It is that moment between the last moment of Mets baseball the previous year and the first scheduled pitch of next year. And got to use that word scheduled because we've seen the last few years the season not get off as scheduled. But let's hope this year it does. If you're not doing anything this Tuesday night, January 3rd, at approximately 7:11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, look to the sky and you will see above you a baseball flying directly overhead because that is where we will be in the baseball equinox. Equidistant from Starling Marte having made the last out of the first round of the playoffs and the first pitch scheduled most likely to come out of the hand of Sandy Alcantara in Miami on March 30th. So we're closing in on it. And it's always good when it's right around New Year's because that gives some real meaning to the idea of Happy New Year. Because before you know it, we are on the other side of the equinox. We're heading for pitchers and catchers and all their teammates and any day now.
That is just awesome, the concept of a baseball equinox. And actually this year, my favorite gift I got was a trip to spring training. My daughter's actually taking me to spring training. We're going to go either for the first game on February, I believe it's 24th or 5th, or whatever it is, we're flying down that Saturday morning. And the game's actually a night game, so Mets fans, for pre-planning purposes, the Mets play their first spring training game on a Saturday, and it's a 6:10 start, which is a bit unique, so I'm looking forward to that.
Excellent.
Yeah. So, all right, gentlemen, it's time to start talking Mets baseball. So let's see. Our last podcast was December 9th, and that was the day after the winter meetings had come to a close. It was a Friday. And we talked a lot about the moves the Mets had made, such as Verlander, such as Quintana. We talked about that. So since then, what's happened? Well, the Mets have brought back Adam Ottavino, certainly a solid thing to do. They have shed James McCann, although not his salary. They're paying 75% of his salary. So James McCann is gone. And then there's this little matter of Carlos Correa. We went to bed on Tuesday night, December 20th, any other night, right? And in the middle of the night, the Mets, and I say in quotes, signed Carlos Correa. Metsville was ecstatic, right? The next day, the Mets sold $1 million worth of tickets. That's been well publicized. And then on Christmas Eve, on Saturday, December 24th, we got the not so fast. So we got the, as we know, the reason Correa was available is that the San Francisco Giants had identified something in his physical, forcing them to back out before the ink was dry. So now the Mets have identified something in Correa's physical and his medicals, and that is now 5 days ago. There essentially is no news other than speculation that, you know, we've heard 55% that this will happen because it works for both sides. I saw somebody say 51%, one of the different writers say 51%. So it's been mum for the most part, other than speculation. And of course, we have to start with the Correa thing. So, Greg, let's tee you up right away as our guest. What were your thoughts when you first heard that the Mets had found a way to bring Correa in? And what are your thoughts right now about the fact that it's in radio silence for 5 days after we heard of a potential issue?
My thought when I first heard about it was, is there anything Steve Cohn can't do? Because we were looking at one of the top players on the market who we assumed was spoken for, had made his choice, and it was just a matter of formality that he's introduced by the Giants. And we'd heard about the press conference that was not taking place in San Francisco, but you know, we were busy being introduced to Cody Senga and to Justin Verlander, so I wasn't too distracted by that, except for the fact that at the very last hour, literally, before the Giants were announced as having reached agreement with Correa, that the Mets were suddenly, you know, true players and were going to make a big offer. And this dream scenario of Correa bringing his talents to Flushing Beach, shall we say, and playing some third base alongside of his compadre, Mr. Lindor, it was out there in the atmosphere for about an hour, and then it faded away, and then they postpone or cancel a press conference in San Francisco, and maybe you allowed yourself 2 seconds to think, oh, I wonder, nah, it's crazy. And then you wake up, like you said, the next morning, there it's happening. So I was pretty happy with the idea because right up to that point, I think that the Mets had done a lot of fortifying what they had and securing certain positions and roles on the team that could have gotten away and didn't. And, you know, some of the names changed, but the talent has replaced talent. But then you step back and you said, well, that's great. This was a team that won 101 games, but are they necessarily better or they just not get worse, which is the difference. And you figure when you heard about Correa, it's like, well, now we're really better. And look at all the great things we can do and look at all the lineups we can put together. And then, like you said, not so fast. What do I think now? I figure waiting for definitive news is better than being told definitively that it's off. I suppose it's better that the Mets know about this business with Correa, ankle, leg, whatever it is, that might be a ticking time bomb, to use overly dramatic phrasing. But I hope it can get worked out because it doesn't appear to be the sort of thing that is going to keep Correa from playing next year or the year after, like everybody here on this call, I think. I'm not a doctor, but from what I've heard, and again, it's no more reliable than 55% or 51% or all the estimations that are being spewed out there. It doesn't sound like something that's going to, you know, you're going to sign him and then, he can't play for the next 12 years. I guess it does bring up the idea of, boy, 12-year contracts are crazy, even if that's the going rate. So I began by saying, is there anything Steve Cohen can't do? Well, I guess we've seen something Steve Cohen can't do. Steve Cohen can't magically repair whatever is within Carlos Correa's anatomy to make this thing a done deal. But I would like to believe it's still on the table, and as long as it's on the table, it hasn't cleared away, and it has a chance to finally happen.
Yeah, that's kind of where I am with it, too. And, you know, you wonder what they're talking about right now. Logic would tell you, and who knows, logic would tell you they're probably talking about length of contract, because if it's something degenerative that might, you know, in the, quote, out years of a contract become an issue, are they thinking about maybe an 8-year deal at a slightly higher AAV or something like that? Who knows? But that might be where it is right now. So, Mike, I'll turn to you on this one. When you heard about Correa, what was your immediate thought? Like, were you already, you know, thinking about different lineup combinations? And then where do you stand with it right now? Do you think the Mets are being duly cautious, or are you kind of over it and you want a resolution?
I'm a little bit out in left field on this one. The news struck me by surprise. Was I happy to hear that we signed Correa? Yeah, without a doubt. But these contracts, Rich, these type of contracts just riddled me with anxiety. Now, on the one hand, Mr. Cohen said, I made the fans a promise. And, you know, this is him fulfilling that promise. I get it. What I'm afraid of, and where a major portion of my apprehension lies, is with the other owners. I'm afraid now that Mr. Cohen is on the landscape, you know, they're going to start chirping about the salary cap. And that's my fear. It really has nothing to do with this conversation, but that's my overriding concern with this whole matter. Will Correa make the team better? Yeah, without a doubt. I'm kind of upset is not the right word. I'm kind of a little miffed over what role Brett Beatty and Vientos might have in the near future, because there's certainly no space on the left side of the infield for them. So, you know, what lies in store for them? I question that, but I welcome Carlos Correa. I don't think this injury business is anything for us to get all bent out of shape over. Seems to have been going on for a while, and he deals with it, he plays with it. So I'm happy. I was surprised. Yeah, I kind of, you know, imagined lineups in my mind. And but I'm afraid of the finances. I'm afraid of the finances. And that other smaller market organizations and their owners are going to use this as the case for a salary cap. Oh, look what Mr. Cohen is doing, blah, 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 all things of that nature. When, you know, this millennium alone, you know, we can go back to the 70s, we can go back to the 80s. There's another team in town. And, you know, they used to go about their money spending in a very, very generous manner. And never once did I fret over salary cap. That's where I am now, because the boss, George Steinbrenner, is no longer part of this landscape. And you got fresh voices who are leading the charge, and I think they view Mr. Cohen as somebody who's here to upset the landscape of MLB. I hope that's not the case. I hope they don't act on that premise. But that's where my mind is, Rich.
And I think that's very fair, Mike. We could talk more about salary caps. I think that should be something we talk about, you know, and is there now or will there be an anti-Mets bias in the league? And or, you know, will Mr. Cohen's presence maybe raise that topic that we know would shut the game down probably for a while, you know, the next CBA? So, Sam, we want to go to you on this one. You're somebody who's up late at night, and I believe you might have tweeted or texted us at 3 in the morning, if I remember, that, hey, guys, they signed Correa. So, you know, where were you? Were you working at the time, and how do you feel about it now?
Well, I guess that I always think that people have control of their do not disturb. So Phil Maylard, to give him a shout-out, was the one that broke the news to me while I was bartending at Rudy's. And obviously, immediately, I was like, what? No way, right? Except, Rich, here is the kicker. It was Mesmerized Online, an article from them, that did give me pause, and I ran to Twitter, figuratively speaking, of course, and saw John Heyman's specific timeline. And there was literally no baseball fan, let alone a Mets fan, around that I could talk to about it. Like, it became, you know, where were you when? And I will always remember that I was at Rudy's, and one person walked in with the Mets hat on, and I was really excited. Like, did you hear the news? And it's becoming, like it used to be, you could guarantee that somebody wearing a blue and orange Mets cap was a diehard. You know, we used to nod at each other on the streets like we were in a secret society, whereas with Yankee fans, you can never know if somebody's actually a Yankee fan or just wearing the hat. It's becoming that, you know, stylistic to wear a New York Mets hat, that, you know, in vogue, if you will. And he turned out to not be a Mets fan, and I was just like, can't even talk. Like, I was like, where's the Yankee fan? I'm not going to gloat about it, but I just need a baseball fan to talk to. And of course, you know, I'll start with this in terms of the narrative. It seems as if the difference between the Giants and the Mets is, one, this is the second time it's happened, and also, let's put it out there, everybody thinks he failed the physical. It doesn't sound like he failed the physical. Something came up in the medicals is what has been reported, and people need to remember that. He didn't fail his physical. There's just concern. And you know, the difference between the Giants and the Mets, I believe, is the fact that the Giants are not one player away. The Mets arguably are, you know, obviously that's subjective, but they're closer right now than the Giants are. And the Giants definitely said, well, you know, we need to restructure this, and got immediately called Steve Cohen. So I think a part of it is also the fact that Scott Boras is kind of realizes that, you know, there's really only one place currently, other than some other teams that we heard that could get back into the mix or are currently in the mix. But all indications are pointing to both sides trying to work this out, because this is everybody's preference, both on the Mets' part as well as Correa's. Going to Steve Cohen, and, you know, I understand everybody's concerned about the budget, but we are obviously in a unique position with Steve Cohen. And, again, that does give the other owners pause. But he's also kind of exposing them, that there's kind of been this gentleman's agreement that you were going to hide behind, kind of the way Jeff did in terms of the underdog side of things, Jeff Wilpon, that is, that other owners that are billionaires that have some of these small market teams hide behind the idea that, well, we're a small market, even though they're pocketing as much money via revenue sharing and TV deals as other teams are. So, yes, he's stirring the pot for sure, and we could be looking down another lockout and or another strike. But in the moment, he's just making a lot of these guys look silly for not – look at the A's situation – for not, you know, reinvesting in the fans that invest so much time and energy into you. Those A's fans love their team and have loved their team for a very long time, and they're just – they're fed up, and Oakland might lose them because of it. Partially. There's so many different nuanced reasons why with that, but this is not an A's podcast. So I think that I do believe – I don't know if it's going to necessarily make or break the Mets. And, you know, I think everybody knows that – that's why they're trying to restructure it, that it might not work down the road, but next year he gives us most certainly a major opportunity, a major chance to – compete for a World Series championship. And once that's done, there's all this other stuff that will now be put into question. Will Beatty and Vientos have different roles, or will they be used in trade purposes? Will Escobar be used in trade purposes? Even though more than McCann, I would like to keep on, I would like to keep a hold of Eduardo Escobar. I think even with Correa at third, he's going to be incredibly valuable as a bench piece slash semi-starter here and there, everywhere. So that's my initial thoughts on it, you know, just having everything that we talked about, and also the fact that it did, in the moment, having it be 3 o'clock, be where were you when? Were you sleeping or were you up? Also, I'll throw this out there, Rich, definitely better 3 a.m. news than the Met fan is used to, that's for sure.
Nah, we didn't fire Willie Randolph, right, this time around at 3 a.m. So, yeah. So, all right. Well, Greg, Sam and Mike have touched on it, so I want to give you an opportunity to weigh in here on the concept of, shall we call it, Steve Cohen changing the landscape of Major League Baseball. Let's face it. With luxury taxes, the Mets will be forking out, if Correa goes through, about $500 million. Of course, they could shed some money, but it'll be relatively minor in terms of what they would shed. So let's just say they're right around $500 million, including luxury taxes. It's, you know, it's a stratosphere where no owner has gone before. And do you think that is maybe bad for baseball, that it's disrupting any kind of competitive balance, and maybe more importantly, that there may be a war on Steve Cohen where it's really 29 against 1 eventually? What are your thoughts, Greg, on the landscape shakeup that Steve Cohen may be causing?
I think it's good for baseball because it's good for the Mets, and I'm incredibly biased in that regard. you know what? Big market team acting like it for a change, for a sea change. So I think what Sam said is kind of the light at the end of this tunnel, which is you're going to have some owners who are shamed and come out and stop pretending that this is somehow not a great business for them to be in. And Cohen is ramping up the stakes. And, you know, he's not alone. We've seen a bunch of other teams make big investments. We lost our ace from the last 9 years because another team was willing to throw a lot of money at him. Maybe he didn't go out and get several Jacob deGroms, but he certainly in Texas invested in a number of free agent pitchers. And we've seen with Philadelphia, we've seen San Diego. So, I mean, again, Cohen is at another level right now. As far as the salary cap, I mean, that's the sort of thing that would have to be collectively bargained. And unless you bring in a salary floor to go with it and get some of these teams to act as if they are not quadruple A teams, I don't see anybody agreeing to it. Again, they tried to put a salary cap in place in the 94 strike. It got nowhere. It's not something that can be done unilaterally as far as I know. Again, if one team is, you know, completely outspending the field and putting other teams out of business or something like that, then maybe that's something to think about. But I don't really see that as the reality of the situation. I think a lot of small markets or mid markets or cheap markets, cheap owners will cry unfair. But I, like all you guys and anybody listening to this, most likely have been waiting for the New York Mets to act like the New York Mets. We probably weren't expecting it to the extreme, and we probably weren't expecting it this soon. Steve Cohen sees no reason to wait around. And I, again, it's bias, absolutely sure. Will somebody try to get a cabal going to say we got to stop this guy? But much as they've tried to, you know, put in a Steve Cohen tax, no doubt. Should we take it personally? I'm not going to because, you know, this is how fandom works. Everybody, if the Mets are successful, everybody is going to be against them. And if the Mets are not successful, the Mets will be an object of derision. I'll just, you know, finish my thought with, you know, I've heard the line that this is buying a pennant. I don't think it's buying a pennant. I think it's shopping for a pennant, shopping aggressively and, you know, shopping in its own way sensibly, because I don't think anybody among us has had any problem with, oh, why are they throwing this much money at this player? Question the totals, but you can't question, at least before the season starts. I was going to say the results, but you know you can't question the caliber of what you've been shopping for and have been acquiring, to use baseball terminology. So while I suppose any box is Pandora's box in theory, I refuse to worry about that. I've been waiting too long for an off season like this. On top of an off season like last year, remember it's only 13 months ago that Starling Marte, Mark Canha, Eduardo Escobar were all signed on the same Black Friday, and then at the other side of the Thanksgiving weekend, they signed Max Scherzer, and I think we're so used to it now, like we don't even remember that was like, oh my God, the Mets signed Max Scherzer, so you know, this is how, unless. You know, it's, let's put it this way. Baseball owners, it's going to take uncommon cohesion and competence if they want to stop Steve Cohen, because they've rarely, certainly in the modern era, rarely been able to get their act together to do more than, you know, lock out camp for a few weeks and get anything they were looking for. So I'm going to ride this wave as long as it will take us somewhere.
No, and I think, Greg, you touched on a lot of very important points. You know, one thing I want to point out, and this is not, you know, this isn't a Yankees podcast, but I do find it interesting that a lot of Yankees fans, including some writers who have said that they're Yankee fans or grew up that way, talking about how this is ridiculous, it has to stop, you know, basically throwing, and I'll use in quotes, morality at the Mets and saying this is immoral, you're bad for the game, all this kind of stuff. It's amazing how they forget that this was their team's business model for 40 years. Not two, not three, 40 years. Evil empire, right. Have the highest payroll, all of that. And I'll throw this in the conversation too. Somebody showed that if the Mets end up with Correa, their payroll is roughly, I don't remember the exact number, 370-ish, something like that. The delta between the percentage difference between that and the second highest payroll will be much smaller than when the Yankees used to have the highest payroll in baseball, where the percentage difference to the next highest payroll was much higher. So the water level has gone up. The contracts are bigger now than they were then. So you have to consider context. But all of a sudden saying that when the Mets are doing it, it's somehow immoral or bad, when the Yankees did it for so long, I find that kind of laughable coming from Yankee fans. I just had to say that because it's not on my mind. And then to a point that, you know, Mike, that you made, about these lengths of contracts, you're 100% right. And I think what's happening now, when you see Trey Turner signed for 11 years, when you see Correa possibly signed for 12, I think what owners are doing now is they're saying, look, we'll sign these crazy length contracts knowing that if we get six good years on a 10 or 12-year contract, we've won. You know, we win one or two World Series in those 6 years. We know the player is going to decline. We know the player will not be worth that amount of money or producing at the same level toward the end of this contract, but that's become the new norm. And teams, that's what teams are doing. You know, they're doing this consciously, knowing that it's a bad long-term investment, but they want the short-term gain. Is that because maybe they want to drive up the value of these franchises with a couple of World Series, maybe sell them down the road and let somebody else deal with those contracts? I don't know. But that just seems to be the new normal. So you're listening to the Metsian podcast. We've been on for about 30 minutes, and we're thrilled to have Greg Prince from Faith and Fear and Flushing with us tonight. Now, Greg, you're obvious, as I mentioned earlier in the open, you're very well known in the Mets blogosphere and in Mets world, but maybe if you could just tell folks where they could find your work, where they could find you on Twitter, and maybe just remind people of the books that you have out there.
Sure. Hi, everybody. I'm Greg Prince. I'm the co-writer at Faith and Fear and Flushing, a blog, founded alongside my friend Jason Fry, going on 18 years ago, February of 2005, where the blog for Mets fans who like to read, take that as you will, but, you know, we write about the Mets and write about Mets fandom. And more recently, I started a podcast with another friend of mine, Jeff Heisen, called National League Town. Mets fandom, Mets history, Mets life is what we call it. You can pretty much take from that what you will as well. So anybody who's looking for a lowercase Metsian podcast, not the Metsian podcast here, of course, but another Mets podcast, check us out, National League Town. On Twitter, I am at Greg_Prince. And yes, thank you for mentioning my baseball library, as it were. I have a book called Faith and Fear and Flushing, An Intense Personal History of the New York Mets, kind of a manifesto of Mets fandom, I suppose. A book called The Happiest Recap, covering some of the great games in Mets history from the first portion of the franchise's history. Amazing, again, story of the 2015 Mets. Remember that when we went to the World Series? And a book called Piazza, Catcher, Slugger, Icon, Star, a study of what made Mike Piazza so indispensable in the Mets narrative and how the Mets and Piazza and us as Mets fans all had to come together. So, that is a lot of Mets content for you folks, and happy to provide it. Thank you for listening. Thank you for reading. And if this is all new to you, please check me out. FaithandFearAndFlushing.com is a good place to start.
Excellent. And Greg, and as always, thank you for joining us, and thank you for sharing where folks can find all of the great work that you do. So, guys, I have three major, or major, I suppose, or topics I'd like to get to. And the first one, Mike, I'm going to start with you on this one. I think we can cover it's one topic with two parts. So I mentioned in the open that since our last podcast, the Mets have brought back Adam Ottavino to do you say shore up? I don't think you do when he was here last year, but to, you know, to be in the bullpen, I'll let you comment on whether or not that's shoring up. The Mets have brought back an aging Adam Ottavino, but he is back. And also the Mets have divested themselves of James McCann. So, Mike, your thoughts on those moves?
McCann, I wish him well. I'm looking forward to the days of Francisco Alvarez, period. But, you know, McCann served his purpose. We needed him at the time. I thank him for his efforts. The bullpen? Yeah, absolutely. Ottavino is going to be a good arm for us. We also signed David Robertson. So, you know, the bullpen looks like here at the end of December that it may be one of the team's strengths in the 2023 season. So Ottavino, good move. Bring him back. You know, you can never have enough pitching. You know that, Rich, especially coming out of the bullpen.
I would agree. So we'll go to you, Sam, next on this one. You know, Mets fans, as Mets fans are very colorful, we know. Very colorful reactions to McCann being traded, like, you know, what yours is, and also your thoughts on Ottavino.
I think that McCann is actually going to be really good for that team. Maybe some of the pressure will be off, but also it is a very young team. So I can see the fit specifically for the Orioles of, you know, and I think it was like a player to be named later, and the Mets are taking $75 million, or I'm sorry, 75% of the contract, because McCann's not making $75 million. And so I think it's just one of those that was good fit for a team over in Baltimore that wasn't going to need to give up too much in terms of McCann. Ottavino, you know, Brooklyn boy, I like him on this team. I like the fact that he kept getting better and better. He obviously understood where he was mechanically going wrong earlier in the season, and he became one of our greatest assets out of the bullpen, and certainly took the job from Trevor May, who obviously was injured for a good portion of the time. And it's funny that, you know, this is a recap show, and I'm kind of spacing on all of our other pieces out there, but it really did become the Ottavino-Diaz show at the end of the bullpen by the end of the year. So I think this was a very important piece to retain, and I'm happy that we did so. Yeah, you know, Seth Lugo, of course, was originally the eighth inning guy, and especially with him going to the Angels and also, you know, kind of losing his job, even though he wasn't that bad really all season. And I applaud him for his Mets career, you know, quite the name in Metsian lore that we will be able to discuss going forward and maybe see in an old-timers game one day. So really applaud Seth Lugo for his service to this team, and I wish him well, not too well against the Mets, but I wish him well in San Diego. So that's my thoughts on it. You know, I think out of, you know, if not a must, was a very important piece to retain, regardless of the way bullpen fluctuates. Bullpen numbers a lot of times fluctuate, and the fact that he's getting older.
Thank you, Sam. So, Greg, you'll be bachelor number three here with same question around Ottavino and McCann.
Well, I like Walks in the Moonlight. Oh, I'm sorry. This isn't the dating game. James McCann, good luck. You know, that was it's almost as if when Steve Cohen bought the team, he hadn't quite gotten the hang of going out and getting who the Mets really needed, because that was the winter of JT Realmuto being available, and the Mets let him slide and went with McCann, and if you squinted real hard, their numbers didn't look all that dissimilar. I think we've seen panned out that they are two totally different species of catcher. I hope it works out for him in Baltimore, and I love the fact that we're not, you know, doubling down on James McCann. Two subpar years, well, let's give it a third year and maybe a fourth year, because, geez, look at all he's owed. I'm with Mike on the concept of Francisco Alvarez coming around at some point. And let's not forget last year's number one or first round draft pick by the Mets, Kevin Parada. Catching could actually become a strength as opposed to something that we just kind of have to get through with the likes of McCann, and although he did improve, I think, Tomas Nito. As far as Ottavino, God, yes, you can't have enough pitching, and I think that was a stealth tipping point of the winter, because I don't think you wanted to futz around, to use a fancy phrase, trying to fortify the bullpen. You know, you did see Lugo go. You saw Trevor May go. Joely Rodriguez, kind of a quiet contributor last year, I thought. So you've come around and you've made, you know, David Robertson, Brooks Raley, and now Ottavino, and, you know, throw in Drew Smith. That has the makings of a pretty solid bridge from however long your starting pitcher goes, and hopefully some of these starting pitchers will go pretty long, to Diaz. And Ottavino is that more often than not, we get the guy who comes in and struggles, can't quite get it together in New York, can't get it together as a free agent. Didn't really bother Ottavino. He got better as the year went along. I just want to get to that point again. Never enough pitching. You guys may have noticed a couple of months ago, we lost Bruce Sutter, Hall of Fame closer for the Cubs and the Cardinals and the Braves. And I remember when Bruce Sutter was in his prime, it was the first time I'd heard the phrase, well, it's a seven-inning game. If you can't get to the Cubs by the seventh inning, you're doomed, because Bruce Sutter's going to come in and he's going to pitch the seventh, the eighth, the ninth. And I was thinking, well, yeah, it really did seem that way. And I found myself looking at box scores, and I found a game I vaguely remember from September of 1980. Get a load of this bullpen strength on the Chicago Cubs one night in September of 1980. Willie Hernandez, who went on to win a Cy Young and MVP a few years later for the Tigers. Bill Caudill, who became a top-notch closer for a few years in the American League with the Mariners. Dick Tidrow, briefly a Met, we'll probably remember him here in New York for the other team as a big-time swingman, set up Sparky Lyle, had some great years in the Bronx. Then Bruce Sutter comes in and throws three shutout innings, and this game goes into extra innings, and a young Lee Smith comes in and throws two innings, and the Cubs go on and beat the Mets, who, by the way, feature Neil Allen and Jeff Reardon, top-notch closers along with Tom Hausman in this game. And these were two terrible teams, by the way, who were about to finish fifth and sixth between them. But it just struck me that, you know, we say you can never have enough pitching in 1980, when you were still in the age of, oh, he's going to go out and throw nine. You couldn't have enough pitching, couldn't have enough relief pitching. So getting Ottavino out there ahead of Diaz, getting Robertson out there ahead of Ottavino, and I'm sure the order will change and other names and faces will emerge. Yeah, I think, you know, for all the excitement over Justin Verlander and Kodai Senga and hopefully Carlos Correa, and keeping Nimmo, and of course keeping Edwin Diaz, that was a big move, and I'm really glad they did it.
Same, and Greg, I want to thank you for that walk down memory lane. That was wonderful to hear that about that box score, and you know, and you wonder why the Cubs let Sutter become a free agent and go to the Cardinals. Well, they had Lee Smith, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that young Lee Smith, who became oh my God, he was scary when he would come in like, you know, 82, 83, 84. He just would come in and throw aspirin tablets up there, and he was a big dude staring you down. I would not have wanted to be in the box against that guy.
For about 10 minutes in the off season that followed, the Cardinals had Raleigh Fingers.
Wow, that's
they
right.
They made a trade and were on their way, and then they flipped him to the Brewers, and then they would meet. Sutter and Fingers were on opposite sides of a World Series within a couple of years, which is neither here nor there, other than to say, my God, what a lot of relief pitching at what felt like the dawn of the closer era.
My goodness. I believe we lost Willie Hernandez years ago, right?
I believe so.
Yeah, I think I remember that. I'll look that up while you guys are answering the next question. All right, so what I'd like to do next is, and I'll start with you on this one, Mike, is go to what I like to call positional permutations. If the Mets, assuming they sign Correa, a couple of things I want to talk about. We'll do them one at a time, and I'll go around with both of them. Catching. So we didn't talk about it yet, but the Mets did sign Omar Narvaez. And nice move, you know, left-hand hitting, power-hitting catcher. Certainly appears as though the catching duties might go to Narvaez and Nito. It makes sense as a platoon. But Alvarez could throw a wrench in that. I mean, so, Mike, my question to you, and it'll be the same to everybody, of course, is how would you handle that? I mean, are you one of those guys who thinks, well, you know what, no matter what he does in spring training, Alvarez, we have two solid catchers on the major league roster. Let's just let Alvarez go to AAA and have a little more time there. He didn't have a lot of time in AAA, and I'm told that Willie Hernandez is still with us. That's good to hear. Do we do that, or do you say, Mike, if he wins a job in spring training, do you keep him on the squad as a DH part-time catcher? How do you handle the catching situation, Mike?
I'm prepared, you know, as a fan to go into the season with Nito and the gentleman you just signed. Insofar as Francisco Alvarez, win the day. I don't want him winning the day in spring training. Let him start in the minor leagues, AAA, whatever have you. Let him perform. Let him earn his promotion. And let him earn that position behind the plate. Win the day. So I'll start the season with two major leaguers. But I'm anticipating the arrival of Francisco Alvarez. When that moment comes, that's up to him. But I'm looking forward to it. So I'll leave it at that, Rich. Win the day.
So, Mike, you wouldn't keep him around as a DH. If I said you could have him around as a DH or you could have him go to AAA, hone his craft behind the plate, which one would you take?
You just said I'd rather him go to AAA, get behind the plate, hone his craft, learn the skills and the nuance of being a fine defensive catcher.
Awesome. Greg, what are your thoughts on the catching situation, particularly around Alvarez?
Oh, I think Narvaez is probably here as something of a mentor to Alvarez, and that's a great move. And I don't think it has to be from day one. I was surprised to see Alvarez show up when he did late in the season. I understood at the time why they were doing it. Top prospect, needed hitting on the major league team, worth a shot. They decided he was mature enough to handle it, and I'm sure six games in the major leagues neither torpedoed his progress nor did it elevate him to the point where we can pencil him in for opening day. But yeah, this is if he is the future at this position, again, along with Parada, a name I think we'll be hearing more about in the years to come, no need to rush. Again, we have the makings of probably a fairly strict platoon because Narvaez is a left-handed hitter. And again, like I said, Nito came along last year. Remember, he was nominated for a finalist for the Gold Glove, got a few key hits. You wish, you know, you could get more out of that position. Often last year, I would just find myself thinking, well, it's a terrific team until you get down to the DH and the catcher, and you should be able to be terrific for seven spots and get something out of 8 and 9. As far as Alvarez at DH, I could see him maybe working his way in, but you know, not from the beginning, maybe. And again, just to bring it back to Correa for a sec, if you have Correa at third base, my God, Eduardo Escobar is a pretty good DH to share time with Vogelbach. Plus wherever else he might be playing in the field. So, you know, a lot of options there. So, again, yeah, the future is coming, but no need to rush it.
I would agree. I think to make him the DH and a part-time catcher does him no favors. I don't think he hones his craft behind the plate by catching once a week. And, you know, clearly he needs a little work back there. That's what you have a minor league system for, and that's why you have serviceable catching on the roster with Narvaez. And, you know, that's my take on it. Sam, what is yours?
I think there's a lot of different directions this roster could go. It's a very nuanced conversation about where Alvarez, as you know, from a personal perspective, is most utilized in development. And I'm going to start with Omar Narvaez right now, because this is also a stealth move that's also a, you know, low risk, high reward, considering he's not that far away from putting up some pretty solid power numbers and not too shabby with the bat on the occasion. He was an all-star in 2021, of course, and you could see him just kind of be a sleeper candidate to bounce back. So that's one of the reasons why it's a good move. And they're considering the fact that, like, well, if they're getting, like, similar production out of Tomas Nito and Omar Narvaez, then that's okay as long as the rest of the lineup, you know, you're not getting 168, which is what you were getting out of McCann. I understand where you guys are all coming from in terms of him working, you know, as a catcher on a daily basis in AAA. But I do wonder that if his bat is ready and he shows that his bat is ready, similar to the way Pete Alonso did, and Pete Alonso's bat ended up being more ready than anybody's giving him credit for, I do wonder whether it is good for him to be watching professional catchers, professional major league catchers on a daily basis, take on a pitching staff as good as the Mets has the potential to be, and not, you know, not just being on the bench and watching it, but as a platoon, a right-handed platoon to Vogelbach, with Escobar sometimes taking the reins as a switch hitter. That's why Escobar is such a valuable piece to really not move if you're looking at it. And he was also great in that clubhouse. That's a whole other tale that we're talking about. I do wonder whether it is a plus for his development, both as a catcher and as a major league player, to be on this major league roster as a right-handed platoon for DH.
Interesting take, Sam. I like what you said. I find it interesting what you said about watching two. I think Nito's a very good defensive catcher. Narvaez, I don't have enough background on him, but I believe he is considered to be a good defensive catcher. So watching them, maybe as primarily a DH, and then watching the pitching staff handling that major league pitching staff on occasion, it's a different way to go. My initial thought was aligned with Greg's and Mike's, which is let him be a full-time catcher and become a very good catcher. And we have to remember, he didn't have a whole lot of time in AAA. That's my initial thought. But I like the way you raised the contrarian view, and you made a couple of very good points there. So thank you for that. Gentlemen, the next thing I'd like to go to in my positional conversation is left field. And there's a lot to unpack here. So let me just start by throwing out some thought starters. And then, Sam, since your vocal cords are warm, we'll start with you on this one. So, left field. Mark Canha is the obvious answer. He played a very good left field last year, you know, came up with some good hits. He did fade at the end. So Canha is the incumbent. Okay. Canha also, I believe, is around $12 to $15 million this year. So if you're looking to lighten the payroll just a little bit, and yes, it would be a deck chair off the Queen Mary, but Canha might be somebody who has value. He might not have to eat a lot of his salary if you trade him. So anyway, so Canha is one option. Another option that I'm hearing is maybe Beatty or Vientos, particularly Beatty. One of those guys playing left field, you know, basically a new position for them to get their bats in the lineup. So let's talk about left field, Sam. Do you want to stick with the incumbent in Canha? Do you want to maybe give the kids a shot? Again, this is all assuming Correa is signed and third base and left side of the infield is locked up for the next 10 years. So where would you go with left field?
It's a really good question. You know, I'm not saying that Mark Canha could potentially, like, break the clubhouse apart, but I do, considering how often there is turnaround this, these in this era, I do wonder whether, you know, Mark Hanna, who did seem to really just have this, like, kind of understated personality where at first he seems to not to be very dry and stoic, but then all of a sudden he had a lot of personality that would come out, especially like on moments where he was mic'd up on ESPN and that whole how do you pronounce it because of his Portuguese background moment. He had a lot of big hits. As you said, faded a little bit at the end with those big hits, but played a good left field as well, should be stated. And I do find it fascinating that we were really like in the Wilpon era, it was all about like enough of these switching positions and trying somebody at the major league level to develop in left field. I wonder whether partially considering Jeff McNeil has been so prolific everywhere from a defensive standpoint, that's changed our tune. Dominic Smith was really the last one that it didn't work out. And it continued, like they wouldn't last year when he was up here, and unfortunately it didn't work out for him at DH, but they wouldn't, he was only the backup for Pete. They never, if I remember correctly, at no point did he ever play any left field. Correct me if I'm wrong. And I'm sure Greg will remember. So it's interesting to me, though, and I think it is an organizational thing that we do believe that there's more competency to be able to transition a Beatty or a Vientos into left field, and that could potentially wreak a better lineup if they develop into better major league hitters currently than Mark Hanna is also currently as a veteran that he is. So that's kind of my take, and of course I'm sure you're going to mention, Rich, that I don't have the list in front of me, but I believe there are, even though J.D. Martinez just went off the books, but there are some other free agent options that we could possibly look to that have better numbers than Canna would probably provide.
And that, looking outside the organization, is yet another option. So, Greg, as you respond, I'll go to you next on this one. How would you handle left field? Again, I'd like to get your comment on the internal options that we've been talking about. And if there is a free agent out there, as Sam mentioned, who might be of interest to you, by all means, you know, feel free to bring that in. Before I move to you, though, I do want to point out that Canna last year, he ended up at 266, 13 home runs, 61 RBIs. So a very solid, we'll call it, year. Not a great year. Solid year. Not a bad year by any means. So, Greg, where would you go with left field?
Yeah, I think Canna fit in really well on the 2022 Mets, and I also think there's room for improvement. I remember Tyler Naquin was projected as somebody who was going to bolster that position and maybe give Canna a breather. It didn't really work out with Tyler Naquin. And Brett Beatty's intriguing. I guess he's played a little left field in the minor leagues. I think it came up again. Keep coming back to Correa here. I mean, if Correa is your third baseman, Brett Beatty isn't, and Brett Beatty is a left-handed batter, and that would be a nice platoon to think about. And again, McNeil, like Sam said, has shown he's one of, you know, he kind of transcends the idea of just being a versatile player. You know, he is that, you know, I'll call him modern, even though the guy wasn't around so long ago, kind of a modern take on what Ben Zobrist was in the last decade. Ironically, the Mets had tried to sign Ben Zobrist after they lost him in the World Series. But, you know, we've seen McNeil blossom wherever he's played. Then again, if you just want to leave McNeil at second base and continue to team him with Lindor, the two of them having, you know, shown that they don't have to worry about rats and raccoons anymore and can turn a double play very nicely, that's fine too. And, you know, you use Guillorme where you have to use Guillorme, or, you know, somebody, if, again, Correa is a Met, maybe somebody gets traded. I don't know what it says to you as the third baseman in waiting, as Beatty might have been when they said, we're not waiting for you anymore. Maybe your future is somewhere else, or maybe it's at that other position. I'll be honest, I really can't think of any external options at the moment. It felt like I'm sure that the free agent market, the shelves haven't been altogether picked clean. There's still names out there, but I'm not on top of that, so I'm going to take a pass on that. But just to say that I really came to like Hanna last year. He may not be your 150-game solution in left field, but I think you could do worse than Canna plus. And you know, the key is the plus, and maybe it is Beatty.
Hey, Rich, so before Mike, you go to Mike, I've been looking at exactly up to the minute as much as possible who is available still at left field. And this happened 10 hours ago, this article on Just Baseball, so if anybody needs to correct me, by all means. But it looks like Jurickson Profar is still available, A.J. Pollock, David Peralta, Tommy Pham, and those are the names I'm seeing right in front of me. There are still some intriguing names out there that, after Correa, you know, we think, all right, Correa rounds it out, but maybe he doesn't.
No, thank you for that, Sam. And, Mike, as I go to you, and I've been looking forward to your comment because I know well, I don't want to bias you, but I know you have a pretty good handle on the minor leagues. You know, you go to a lot of the Brooklyn games. You've seen a lot of guys like Vientos and Beatty come through. So I'm very interested to take your take, and you could also include some of the names that Sam just mentioned on how you might handle left field.
I'll start with names that Sam mentioned. No, thanks. I'm patient with left field. I'm prepared to go into the season with Marcana. And I'm hoping he just keeps the position warm for either Beatty or Vientos. As you mentioned, you know, being a Brooklyn Cyclone fan and going to many of the games, I saw Greg Beatty up close, but not as an outfielder. Now, Greg mentioned that Beatty did gain some experience in the outfield this past season. And I think Vientos played more outfield this past season than not. So the organization for both players has been pushing them to gain some outfield experience. And, you know, if we're going to start the season with this triangle of Canna, Beatty, and Vientos, I'm comfortable with that. I don't really feel the Mets need to go off campus and bring in another name. I think they'll do just fine with perhaps Marcana starting the season, and maybe a Vientos or a Beatty finishing the season. I want to see these guys get promoted. I want to see those guys get some playing time. It doesn't have to be April, but, you know, I'm looking towards a fine finish of the season with them included.
Thanks, Mike. And you're listening to the Metsian Podcast. We've got about an hour in the books. A couple more things to talk about before we wrap it up for the evening. We have the Metsian Podcast with our special guest, Greg Prince. So one more positional thing I'd like to talk about. And, Mike, I'll start with you on this one, keep you warm here. And that would be DH. You know, we've kind of danced around it on the podcast so far. I think it's pretty safe to say Naquin won't be back. Vogelback has been signed. He could always be traded, but Vogelback has been signed for 23. But here's the conundrum, in quotes, that I have. So Escobar is another guy. If Correa is on the team, Escobar is not needed at third base. Okay. I believe he's $12 million next year. Again, is this somewhere maybe you look to shed salary? I personally would not. I think he's an excellent – he's a switch hitter, so he's a two-for-one sale right there. But secondly, he could play basically all – I assume he can play all four infield positions. He certainly can play second, third, and short. He is your ideal backup infielder and DH and switch hitter. He's really like the Swiss Army knife. But look, talk to me about DH, Mike, with Vogelback, maybe Escobar. Should they trade Escobar? Should they use one of the kids to complement Vogelback, you know, the right-handed side with Vientos? Should they go off campus? What are your thoughts on DH?
I'm very comfortable with Eduardo Escobar. If he's of a frame of mind that he can stay on the bench and just DH, that would be a huge plus. I don't think they have to go out and acquire a bat just for DH. I think we're okay. And if Eduardo Escobar can fill that role, I'd be very, very content. as you say, Rich, he's a switch hitter. So that's, to me, a plus-plus. He's a 33-year-old. His birthday's coming up in a couple of days. So I'm very contented to have Escobar as a DH.
Escobar is just an ideal bench player. I mean, I don't mean to, you know, speak bad. I'm not trying to speak badly of him, but he just could do so many things. So, Greg, you know, for a guy who hosts something called National League Town, can you believe that here it is 2022, almost 2023, and we're talking about the DH in the National League? Anyway, that's a topic for another show. but we do have the DH, and we have to talk about it. As much as I hate the DH still, but we still have to talk about it. So how would you handle it?
Yeah, as a tiny violin playing in my heart, the fact that we are talking about it. Listen, I mean, Vogelback became, with all due respect to Dom Smith and J.D. Davis and everybody, for that matter, whoever, you know, played an interleague game at that position, really became the first Mets DH who was here because that's what he was here to do. And he was here to do it half the time against right-handed pitching. And he did a phenomenal job. I mean, anything that you got out of Daniel Vogelback was the quintessential Vogelback, and unfortunately he can't be out there every day. Escobar strikes me as the kind of guy who would do anything to help the team win, which, you know, may sound rather Pollyannish. For all I know, Eduardo Escobar is sitting home with us, you know, sticking pins in his Carlos Correa doll, but that doesn't strike me as the sort of thing he'd be doing. And yeah, it would be a, I don't want to call it a demotion, but it would be not exactly a lateral move to say, okay, you're the DH half the time, you'll be filling in here and there. But, you know, if you could get that from Escobar, who could be just so en fuego, shall we say, for portions of the season. You know, he was the National League Player of the Month in September. He hit for the cycle. You know, we can call out his highlights. There were dry spells as well. But, you know, there's less pressure. Not, you know, you're going to sit at the end of the bench and have no pressure, but, you know, less pressure than saying, okay, you're one of the free agents and you have to go play third base and be in that fifth, which I think he did for a while last year. This what strikes me the more I think about it as a really good landing spot for Escobar. And, yeah, I don't know where they would go exactly. And I guess even though I'm only in year two of living with the DH as a reality, it doesn't seem like the kind of thing you necessarily want to put a youngster at that position and say, you know, this is your life now. I don't know, you know, where Vientos's future is ultimately. And I saw him strike out an awful lot in September. So I'm not quite as high on Vientos as I might be on the other two prospects on the cusp that we've talked about. But, you know, if you have the opportunity to let these guys become actual major league players and not fall into you can only do one thing at this stage of your career, I think that's a road I would rather take. But I'm, again, I suppose if, again, the Korea domino tumbles and other moves are made, I guess, you know, a lot of the guys who we're getting used to might be on the trading block, as they say. But for now, with the people we have and the people we think we're going to have, I would love Escobar in that, you know, deluxe, shall we say, that deluxe role, where he's not a regular, but he's not a reserve. He's somewhere in between, and I think that can only help the team.
I'm a big fan of having, as long as, like you said, as long as Escobar's okay with it, and I can't imagine a 33-year-old not being okay with it, chance to win a World Series and being the Swiss Army knife guy instead of a starter, but I think it would be great. You know, he does so many things. So, Sam, bring us home on DH.
Let me just also throw out there that I like that there's still, and I forget exactly what needs to happen, but there's still a potential to see a pitcher in the game at some point where you have to sacrifice your DH. And again, forget exactly how that happens, but at least there's that. Escobar. Yeah. I think you're absolutely right that he's the Swiss Army knife to repeat in some fashion what you guys just said. But he just seems like such not only a good guy, but also a genuine guy. And it's not a facade. And he's somebody that just makes everybody around you smile more and be better. I'll also say this, that all this talk about Correa and the lineup, you know, this is one of the reasons why I think Correa is vitally important all of a sudden to what this lineup looks like, because as much as I like Daniel Vogelbach and I like the role that he has on this team, and I think that he's also just a fun player to follow, and it seems to fit into that clubhouse to a T, I never want to see him hit behind Pete Alonso ever again. And I'm sure that you guys can echo that sentiment, even if he is going to be the right-handed the right-handed platoon of a DH spot. Like, you're probably not going to get that far, which we didn't, if that's what you were leaning on. So that's my initial take on the DH. And I agree also, do you want to put Vientos into the DH spot and be like, this is your life currently? I wouldn't go that route.
Fair. I'm not a big fan of having young guys like, and I'm talking guys like Vientos and Beatty, who have combined 3 months of major league experience in the DH role. I'm just not a big fan of that. I'd rather see them get traded for their own benefit so they can prosper somewhere else, or start the year in the minor leagues and learn a new position there. I believe in the Ron. I'm a big believer in the Ron Gant school, where when they asked him to change positions, he said, "Please send me the minor leagues so I can learn it there, as opposed to embarrassing myself up here." So I do one of those things. Let those guys, if you're going to ask them to change positions, let them do it in the minor leagues or trade them. To ask them to DH at, you know, what are they, 22-ish years old? And no, I just don't think it's a good move. All right, so you're listening to the Metsian podcast with Sam, Rich, and Mike, and our special guest Greg Prince. And we're, you know, we've turned the corner. We're into the home stretch. I want to throw one thing out for general comment, then one more topic that we could roundtable. The one thing for general comment, guys, just anything you might want to say to this, the projections came out this week for number of wins, and the Mets were projected at 103 wins. It was like 102.8. So what do you all think of that? And that's with Correa. So that's only, I say only, two games more than last year. I'm a bit surprised by that. I thought they'd be a little higher, like maybe like 107-ish. But general comment, I'm not going to call names, just, you know, do you think this Mets team is accurately projected with Correa at 103? Any thoughts on that?
I'm always curious as to what last year's projections were, and I can guarantee you that the Mets were not projected to have 101 wins. So yeah. I always take it with a grain of salt one way or another.
Fair. Other comments?
I was going to say, I'll take 1-0 on opening night and take it from there. I can't worry about that.
Mike?
I'm on the same train. That's something I don't pay attention to.
Fair enough, because you don't know, right? First game of
right.
the season, somebody could go down. You can make a big trade in the middle of the season, get a lot better. Who knows?
Right.
Okay, so guys, I want to roundtable this one, and I'm gonna talk a bit to give you a chance to get your thoughts together. The title of our show is Wrapping Up the Metsian Year, and so I do think it's important to talk about the highlight of the year or highlights of the year for you. I will start. And I'll say I'm kind of cheating here because we did a Metsmerize roundtable and I had a chance to think about this already. I'm going to come out with this one. So my Metsian moment, my highlight of the year as I reflect back on 2022, and I'm not going to ask you to give me dates. I looked this one up myself. It was May 5th when the Mets played at Philadelphia, and you know exactly what I'm about to say. The Mets were down 7-1 going into the top of the ninth. They scored 7 runs, won the game 8-7. Now, why was that the moment for me, the sentinel moment for me? Okay, we were about a month into the season, and I was, you know, scratching the chin. Man, this team looks like it's just got a little mojo here, looking a little special. And then when they had that game, exactly 1 month, I believe, maybe 1 month to the day, to since opening day, I said to myself, wow, this team has something. This is something you don't see very often, a six-run rally in the ninth inning, a seven-run rally, I'm sorry, in the ninth inning, to win a game on the road. That's the game where my eyes opened very widely, and I said, we might be sitting on something special here. Yes, I know it didn't end in the special way we all wanted it to. But as I look back at the year, you know, I thought about other games. I thought about the game at Dodger Stadium where they won in extra innings. I thought about that. There were others, too, you know, like when they beat the Yankees the first game at Citi Field, the Scherzer start where Diaz came in. He made an error. Remember, he made an error in the ninth inning on a ball and a squibber. He dropped it, and he had to strike out. I believe he struck out. No, he walked Judge. He struck out somebody in the game. I don't remember who it was, but that was a big one. So you have all these different games, and it doesn't have to be a game. It could be a moment. It could be maybe it's for you. It's Buck Showalter, whatever it is. But as we look back at the 2022 season, what was your moment? That's my question. And so, or moments, if you want to be plural. So, Mike, I'm going to start with you on this one.
I'm with you on that one specific game, Rich. But there's another game. On September 28th, when we played the Marlins, and we walked it off in the 10th inning, less than six or seven games left in the season at that point. And, you know, I thought that was going to become a magic moment. It didn't work out that way. But that game in late September, that's the kind of game you want to see played in late September. And I felt a little bit of Mets magic that night, Wednesday, September 20th, to be exact. Otherwise, you know, I enjoyed the season. I don't want to say I didn't. It was a lot of fun. But I compartmentalize because there's a lot of 2006 and 2007 that was whipped up in the season that just ended. So the game you brought up, that one game against the Marlins, because it was late September and things were so hot between us and the Braves, I thought that was going to be, you know, one of our magical moments. It was on that Wednesday night, and it lasted, you know, through Thursday. But then we arrived in Atlanta, and we know how that worked out.
Mike, I want to thank you for bringing that up because I was at that game, and that was actually my second choice. I should have mentioned that in my little soliloquy there. I remember being at Citi Field for that game, Taijuan Walker on the mound, and I was sitting – I'm out of my 50s. I was sitting in my seat pouting because they were down 4-0. I don't want to talk to anybody. I was there with my family. They knew not to bother me. I was sitting there with a blank look on my face. And I was acting like a child, basically. And then when Escobar hit the two-run home run to make it 4-2, and then when he hit the two-run single with the bases loaded to tie the game, sending it to extra innings. If you remember, they almost won in the ninth. Nito hit a ball off the wall. They got the ghost runner in the 10th, and they scored, you know, Escobar drove in all five runs. So, yes, thank you for bringing that up. Because in the ninth inning, we heard that the Braves had lost. They had lost to the Nationals 1-0. And the Mets, if they won that game, which they did, had a chance to go up by a game going in. You know, they would have had the tiebreaker with one. We know all that, right? But, yeah, that was an amazing moment. And thank you for bringing that up because that was quite a thrill. You know, nothing like – it was kind of like an 86 vibe, you know, where they're losing and you're like, ugh. And then there's nothing like a win after you thought it was a sure loss. You know, and what a feeling that was walking out of Citi Field that night. So, Sam, I'll go to you next. Did you have a moment, and what was it?
The moment that I had was all of those above, basically. But I have another moment to add after all of that, and that is 10-9 against the Phillies as well. I think that was another game, you know, with the Phillies, ironically, that also was just such a thrill to watch live. And I think that day I was able to watch the entire game just sitting down and watching it. And I think that let's go all the way back to that 8-7 win against the Phillies. I think that's one of the reasons why a lot of Mets fans stayed in the stadium as they were down in the the ninth inning against the Padres, but they seemed to – actually, no, I'm sorry. That was the 7-1 game against the Padres, which was the first game of the series. I think that was a big reason why a lot of Mets fans, while the Mets were kind of making it a little interesting, even though it was two outs, we didn't leave the stadium yet because we had that other game from Philadelphia in mind. And we should also throw out there that it ended up getting Joe Girardi fired, so we actually may have gotten the Phillies to the World Series, ironically. And I also just loved that they kept bucking the trend throughout the year, bucking the Metsian trend, if you will, from years past, of staving off the Braves for as long as they did. And that game that you're talking about is going to kind of, in some fashion, the September 28th game, is going to be looked back upon like Johan Santana in 2008 pitching that complete game shutout 3-0. I think that's basically how this is now viewed, is just like, I remember that day when we had a lot of hope? And it's still something to hold deep to your heart. Everybody always talks about Johan Santana and that game, in many ways complimenting the no-hitter and how legendary of a Met Johan Santana is. So I think that has those vibes. I think that's why I keep saying they need to change the narrative, because it doesn't matter how much they're staving off the competition during the year. Everybody continues to think that the Mets will eventually give it up, and I need the Mets to stop giving it up. I need them to change the narrative, and that's been my mantra going into the offseason.
All good stuff, and I can't think of a better way to have our last major topic wrapped up than with Greg, because Greg has written books about magical moments, as he talked about, in Mets history. So, Greg, I'm sure you've been mulling this over. What was your moment for 2022?
Well, I will give you a bifurcated answer in terms of an actual game. You touched on it briefly, Rich. Dodger Stadium that Sunday, that 10-inning game where it fell to Adonis Medina to be the closer, mm-hmm. because Edwin Diaz had already been used. And that was the moment in my mind where there was no turning back. They had left New York. I think they were at that was the magical 10 games up on the Braves, which we should have known wasn't going to last. But, we'd beaten up on the Nationals, and we'd beaten up on Joe Girardi's Phillies, and we'd played well. There was no doubt. I think even at that point, you knew there was no collapsing that could take place that would just completely tear the team apart. But you had to play the Dodgers, and the Dodgers were the gold standard. And, the idea was you're going to see the Dodgers later if you want to get to the World Series. And to get through that series, remember, it's a four-game series. They lose on a Thursday night. They're probably tired from the flight. They don't look good at all on Friday. They win on Saturday, so you have some hope. And then this, kind of death struggle on Sunday where you're throwing – Trevor Williams is your starter, kind of one of the unsung heroes of 2022, and he puts out a representative outing. I think he went at least five innings, and the bullpen hangs in there as much as it can. Like I said, you use Diaz when you could, and it comes down to Medina after they got him a lead, and Buck had to do that a couple of times. He did it with Yoan Lopez in another game where it's like, all right, go out and get three outs. And something about after that game, I said, okay, there's no, this was a nice try of the season. It's, I don't like the phrase World Series or bust, but it kind of felt that way. And maybe it kind of went bust, but it allowed me, I know, to just look at this team on another level altogether. And it's so much more fun to go into series and go into individual games thinking that you are going to win this game tonight. You are going to take this series this week, as opposed to, gee, I hope we can get lucky. And again, obviously, didn't all work out in the end. We didn't take every series in the end. But I think that just catapulted us to another level. And, you know, all the games that you guys mentioned are definitely up there. But I'm going to move to a pregame as my true moment of the year. And there's no question that this was the highlight of my Met life in 2022 and in recent years. August 27th, Old Timers Day. Great enough as it was. I know I was on the show shortly after, so I'm not going to go over the whole thing again. But, you know, 65 or so Mets there, coming together of the generational tribes, almost like Woodstock. And then on top of that, they retire Willie Mays' number, something that I know we've talked about as in it needs to happen one of these years for years on this show and other shows. And it was actually happening in front of me and in front of 40,000 people. And I couldn't believe it. I'm still almost speechless trying to put the words together. And that this was the cherry on top of a year that had been about getting the past right at Citi Field, which we know was never a priority under the previous regime. And to go from the Tom Seaver statue being unveiled and Nancy Seaver back in the fold to welcome Tom back where he belongs, as she put it, and to spend the whole year tipping a cap to Cooperstown for finally getting it right on their end and putting Gil Hodges in the Hall of Fame and having days to remember him, and the retirement of number 17, something I still can't believe took all these years, and to have Old Timers Day and what that represented after years of being told by Mets management, oh, Mets fans don't care about that. That's not really a Mets thing. Well, of course it was. And finally, Willie Mays, number 24, going up there as it did before the season was over. And it just seemed so perfect that afternoon to say, look at this. We've got a first-place team. We've got a team that we know is going to the playoffs. And we've got all this going on around us. What a way to say happy 60th anniversary. And I know there was one of the people who likes to leave comments on our blog, who I don't think lives in the New York area and may not have seen the ceremonies. And he said, that all sounds great. This was after that weekend. If you remember, they lost 1-0 on Sunday after winning on Old Timers Night. They lost 1-0. He said, that all sounds great, but I would trade all of it for another win yesterday. And I'm thinking, you know what? We don't have to trade. I know, yes, of course, we love another win. But we're now an organization who can walk and chew gum at the same time. And we can feel good about the present, the year that we are in first place and going to the playoffs. And we can feel good about the future because of who owns the team and how it's being operated, and that we've got some players coming along and a great core. And we can feel good that the past no longer has to be kind of put on the back burner, that it's something to be proud of, and we don't just have to tilt at windmills and yell at clouds and all those cliches, that this is a place where it matters. And it felt like it was all coming together that day, and nothing, not even not winning the division and elimination in the first round has detracted from that feeling at all. So with due respect to beating the Dodgers and beating the Phillies and beating the Marlins and all the great on-field times and all of it, is, again, that's the bottom line. That's the standings. That's what we come for. Nothing can beat that moment of realizing, oh, my God, they did it. They're retiring number 24.
Rich, I have to jump in and say, Greg, I couldn't agree with you more. Very quickly, when they retired number 24, it caught me by surprise. I'm sure it caught everyone by surprise. I shed a tear. That's how warming and what a truly great moment. So I have to agree 110% when we retired Willie Mays' number.
I'll also throw it out there, Rich, that I hope there is a day when they can have Willie Mays Day. You know, I think it's partially because it wasn't exactly – he would have overshadowed today, but I don't know. I don't think that's exactly why he wasn't there. But I'm hoping in all good measure from both the Mets perspective as well as Willie is that they can organize a Willie Mays Day and truly honor that moment, even though the number is already up there.
No, he did have hip surgery this year, so it would have been impossible for him to travel. He's going to be 92 next year. I will say, though, for the optimist in us, his son, who accepted the honors on his behalf, Michael Mays, had gone on with Jay Harwitz on Jay's wonderful podcast shortly thereafter and said, my father at 91 is other people at 65. So we can only hope that's an accurate assessment. And while 3,000 miles is a long way to travel for anybody at that stage of life, yeah, I join you in that hope. It, you know, again, it brings back the, well, it would have been nice if they had done it sooner, but we could say that about a lot of things. You know, you guys all are well-versed and may even remember Willie Mays Night at Shea Stadium. I'm sure you've been alerted to the fact that there was a Willie Mays Night at the Polo Grounds when the Mets were born and they wanted to welcome him back to the neighborhood. How great would it be to make it 3-for-3 and let City Field feel some of that magic? But, you know, regardless of whether Willie's ever able to make that trip east again, number 24 is A, off the back of Robinson Cano and everybody else. Not that it was circulated too widely. Boy, that annoyed me. And it's up there. It's up there with 17 and 31 and 36 and 41 and 14 and 37. And whoever else makes the scene in the rafters. So, Mike, I join you in wishing I'd had the Kleenex concession at Citi Field that day because, believe me, sir, you were not alone.
Gentlemen, we have reached the finish line, and what a way to do so. Those Mets memories from 22 and then obviously beyond, you know, with the reference to Old-Timers Day and Willie Mays. Wonderful walk, look back and a little bit of a walk through the 2022 season, which, as we said, did not end the way we wanted it to, but it really was a great season, and we're looking forward to bigger and better things in 2023. I'd like to thank you guys for joining me tonight to talk Mets baseball. What we're going to do is we're going to combine two things. As I go around, I'm going to ask you to do your shameless plug, what you're doing these days in the social media world and where we could find you, and then your last word for tonight. So, Mike, why don't we start with you?
Okie doke. Brooklyn Trolley Blogger. Last season, I recapped the 1890 Brooklyn Bridegroom season. I've been on break since then. You know, the move has come upon me, and once I resettle, I'll get busy again. And, you know, I look forward to the future. And I just want to say I had a blast being on the air again with you guys, the fact that we all could get together again. And I just enjoy truly and greatly my time talking baseball with you guys. And let's go Mets. Final word, Happy New Year to all.
Right back at you, Mike. Love talking baseball with you. Greg, if you could remind folks where they could find your work and what might be your last word for tonight.
You can find me at faithandfearinflushing.com. Transitioning 2022 to 2023 and editorial content pertinent to that. You can find me at National League Town podcast on popular platforms. My thanks to Jeff Heisen, my friend and partner, for getting that together. My thanks to my friend and partner, Jason Fry, for all these years together at Faith and Fear and Flushing. I'm going to be very self-indulgent, sneakily, and say that my last word is happy birthday, Rick Aguilera, because Rick Aguilera's birthday is New Year's Eve. Rick Aguilera was born exactly 1 year before I was, which means it's my birthday coming up too. And I only bring that up because in about 26 and a half hours as we were recording this, I am going to leave my 50s and enter the big 60.
Oh, that's right.
So this is my these are my last public remarks as a 59-year-old, probably in my 50s. And I just have to say I've been. Well, you know, listen, I'm an American male who is obligated to say I've been dreading this moment, but I've been kind of looking forward to it for a long time. Not that I'm really looking forward to being 60 necessarily. I'll never forget a conversation I had with my father the night he turned 60, and you know, we didn't really have anything resembling deep conversations. And so at the time that the night he's 60, I'm 26, and we're going out to, he wants Chinese food for his birthday, so we're going out to pick it up. And I don't even know if I asked him, if I had said, so, Dad, what's it like being 60? That doesn't sound like something I would have asked him, but maybe I just said, I hope birthday's going well or something. And he just says to me, you know I'm 60, but I don't feel any different from when I was 22. And that always, like, stunned me. And I was just wondering, first off, like, the idea that my father was once 22, because that was before I was born, and trying to picture him as anything other than my father. You guys know what I'm saying, probably. And so I've been, like, waiting to find out, well, what's it going to be like when I'm 60? Will I still feel like I did when I was 22, and when I was 22, the Mets had just gotten Gary Carter. They were going to go out and win 98 games and give me, you know, a year I'm still talking about all these years later. And, you know, Doc Gooden went 24-4, and we almost, you know, almost won the division just like this year. So I guess that's a long way of bringing it around to yeah, I guess I don't feel any different because I'm sitting here talking about the Mets and talking to people who also care about the Mets and enjoying the hell out of it, by the way. So, yeah, that'll be my last word. Happy birthday, Rick Aguilera, and anybody else who happens to be turning whatever age they happen to be turning on New Year's Eve. And, yes, of course, Happy New Year's to all.
And, Greg, on behalf of the Messian podcast, happy birthday to you, sir, and thank you for all you do. I mean, your tweets during the games are informative, at times, you know, entertaining. I know you have a great sense of humor. So thank you for all you do in the blogosphere, tweeting, and just being our Messian brother. And once again, I hope you're having a Saturday. So before I turn to our grand poopa of podcasting operations for his shameless plug and last word, I'd like to thank everyone out there for listening, spending some time listening to the Messian podcast, not only tonight, but throughout the course of 2022. And ever since we've been doing it, which it started out as under a different name in 2013, but guys, it's going to be our 10th year next year. So we're really proud of that. Thanks to everyone for listening. You make it all possible. We love the tweets. We love all the comments. We love when people call in, all of that. Thank you to Adam Siegel, who produces our opening jingle that we have. So thanks to him. And Sam, I'm going to allow you to give us your shameless plug, your last word, to take us out, because I know exactly how you're going to do it.
Well, thank you, Rich. I greatly appreciate it. And Greg, happy birthday. What can I say? I've known, of course, in the back of my mind, December 31st, but I appreciate you reminding me, and what a – It's what a birthday, and I hope you have such a great one. And it just, like, listening to you, you know, definitely we've, you know, you've always connected yourself in many ways to, you said on my documentary, you know, Shameless Plug, The Newest Breed, The History Guide to the Mets Fans on Sam Maxwell's YouTube channel. You said on there that, you know, you don't want to necessarily think about this, but you were probably conceived around the exact time that the Mets were first taking the field in St. Louis. And I have called you the Mets fan incarnate, and, you know, chokes me up a little bit because you all bring joy to me in Metsville. I'm so thankful that I've come across you guys and the Mets family. I'm so thankful that I have converted from the baseball brothers across town to the orange and blue. And it's just so special to do this with you on a semi-weekly basis, you guys. And Greg, you know, you more than anybody else really encompasses what it means to be a fan of this team. And I thank you for bringing your knowledge, your spirit, and your camaraderie to this Mets franchise. And last but not least, the only thing that I can say, my final word, change the narrative. I need to, and the Mets do too. And I will also say, because I found out about it while we were on this podcast, RIP Pele. And without further ado, let's go Mets, and Happy New Year, everybody. Take care.
Happy
good night, everybody.
New Year, all. Happy birthday, Greg. Be well.
Thank you.